Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. I'm one of your hosts, Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu, your other host.
And it is time to discuss our March book club pick, What Lies Between Us by Naomi Munawira. Rira, you sold this book to me as a crime mystery novel.
The Goodreads had it under the genres of mystery and crime, and I've heard people say that it was a murder book. So I was like, okay, like we haven't read a crime novel in a while. So I said, yeah, let's pick this one. And oh boy, I was surprised.
I mean, I kept reading, like, when does the mystery come in? A, when does the crime come in too? Because anyways, we'll get into that in our discussion. Before we get there, though, as always, you can chime in as you read the books in our book club or as you listen to us discuss your thoughts about the book and anything else in the Asian American lit world by joining our Goodreads group. We have a Goodreads group at goodreads.com. Just search Books and Boba and introduce yourself. It's always great to see who is reading along with us. And also, since it is April, our April book club pick is?
Our April book club pick is One Day We'll All Be Dead and None of This Will Matter by Skashi Cole. And if you've already read this book, then our May book club pick is The Leavers by Lisa Coe. So,
man, just a lot of just feel-good titles
I'm sorry.
In 2018.
I don't know how that's happened.
I am very excited to read The Leavers, though. It's been on my to-read list for a while. I know, Riras, you've already read it, right?
Yes, I read it when it first came out. Like, I think it was a book of the month pick, so I got it through the subscription, and I actually went to the Romans reading with Lisa Coe there, so that was really cool. Yeah, and I think I handed you the copy that you have in your bookshelf.
Yeah. One of our mutual friends, Quincy Sarah Smith, who is a fellow Potluck podcaster, he hosts the Asian Americana podcast as well as produces the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast. He came into possession of the book, gave it to Rira. Rira says, I already have this book, and Rira gave it to me. So thank you for saving me some money. Although I may want to throw Lisa some cash with the Kindle version or something.
Just buy a second book, have like a distinct version and then like the other version where you write notes and stuff.
Yeah. So no book news this week. We're going to save it for our next episode. But as always, a quick spoiler warning. We are going to be discussing the plot of What Lies Between Us. So if you do plan on reading this book, maybe you should push pause and come back when you're done. Hey, it's Marvin. Just wanted to include a quick trigger warning for our upcoming discussion. As you may know, if you read the book, What Lies Between Us contains a bunch of really heavy stuff, including sexual harassment, potential rape, child abuse, and general trauma. So just wanted to give you a quick heads up. If you are sensitive to these topics, they are upcoming. Thanks. And with that out of the way, first reactions, I guess. What did you think about the book, Rira?
It was very unexpected. Maybe it's because I was sold on it based on its genre. And I mentioned in the previous episode, but the book is more a slice of life, and it kind of goes through the entire childhood and adult life of the main character, and you really get into her head. So it was very, very different from what I thought it would be, but I really liked it. I don't know if I can read it again for the second time, because it was very emotionally draining reading this book. It was really dark.
I mean, it's a book about the passing on of trauma, right? Or how trauma stays with you. And especially when it comes to immigrant cultures that come from like traditions that include patriarchal misogyny and stuff. So no, it's a story where like things just keep getting worse and worse for the main character, even though on the surface things seem to be going okay, right?
Yeah, this book has a lot of it plays with a lot of facades. Like mm-hmm. whatever is depicted on page isn't exactly the entire story, I guess. Like even with like the lush language of the book, because the prose is really beautiful, but all these gruesome things are happening behind that prose, you know? Like like in the beginning of the book, part one, it takes place in Sri Lanka, and the country is embroiled in civil war, but the narrator's childhood, she talks about like living in this gorgeous house and having this beautiful garden. Yeah, because she lives a life of
privilege, yeah, right? She has a very privileged upbringing as a child, kind of detached from the realities of war or the ongoing war in the country. Yeah. Like the civil war, yeah.
Yeah, so you have like this image of like a perfect childhood in this beautiful country, but you know that people are dying in very violent manner. And like same thing with her parents' marriage, like they married out of love. They weren't really in an arranged marriage, I guess. But you find out that the mom has depressive episodes, and the dad is, even though he is wealthy, he still teaches as a professor, and he is a reclusive mm-hmm. alcoholic. So this marriage that's supposed to be like this perfect match isn't really perfect either. So you see a lot of like, I mean, I said facades, but I'm not really sure if that's the right word. But there's like a lot of contrast to it.
Yeah, I think like there's a lot of asymmetric information going on, right? Like it reminded me a lot of the other book we read by Celeste Ng, Everything I Never Told You, where there's a lot that goes unsaid that like the character knows they should be saying or they should have done, but they're not doing it. And a lot of it is couched in this need to protect yourself from consequences, right? What's really interesting is throughout the entire like first part, it's a lot of it is talking about like traditions and yeah, like the main characters, her parents met and fell in love like the what we would consider the normal way, but what they would consider in Sri Lanka during that time as like a very
unconventional style of proposing.
Yeah.
Because like he meets her on a bus and he's like, I think you're pretty, we should get married. And I mean, that's kind of considered normal here because people kind of casually converse with the opposite sex. But mm-hmm. like it's in Sri Lanka, yeah. It's very, the author definitely establishes that traditions are very different there. And there's a very different type of gender guidelines. I'm not sure if that's the right word either, but
I mean, they still practice dowries and the fact that like females are actually not really desired as children because you have to pay money to get them married to a good family. And they still have a caste system. They, you know, like a lot of, what you don't realize until the very end is that there's also a lot of economic like trauma going on, right?
Yeah.
people can't speak out because they're afraid of not being able to provide or being thrown out. And there's a lot of subtle and nuanced ways you get like effed over by a culture that dictates whether or not a person is worth anything in the world.
But aside from that...
Well, I mean, I thought it was really interesting because I didn't realize until the very end that we didn't know the main character's name until the epilogue.
Yeah, yeah. That actually reminded me of The Sympathizer, another book club pick that we did earlier this year. No, it was last year.
It was last May. So a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even in The Sympathizer, it's written kind of in a form of a confession. And midway through, you find out that like not all the information has been relayed to the reader. So the narrator is purposely kind of tricking the reader. And I kind of felt like it was kind of like the same feeling that I got when I was reading the book, because I immediately knew what the crime was. Like, and I was like, okay, it's just a question of what made her do it. And it just kind of built up from there. I don't know. I thought the prologue set up the whole story pretty well. And I think, you know, right off the bat that, I guess this is our first spoiler, that the narrator killed her baby.
Yeah. And that part was really hard to read.
Yeah.
It came so late too in the story. So like part of me was like reading and saying, well, maybe we'll get off without getting to the bad part because it's almost over. But, you know, it's part of the story. And I guess the whole entire story is written in like, it's the narrator is speaking about it like many years after the event. I thought that added a lot to like the ability for the narrator to provide perspective to what was going on.
Yeah, I definitely thought that too. I think Naomi Munawira did a really good job making the perspective, like really got into the character's head, you know, because towards the end of the novel, when the narrator's like mental clarity kind of dissolves, like you kind of go through what the character is thinking, and the logic isn't really like her reasoning is not logical, but you still understand what's going on in her head that drives her to do that horrendous crime. So like I think she did a really good job like getting the reader inside the head of the narrator.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it was hard to read also just because it's like, it was a little frustrating for me to see the main character continually like deny that there's anything wrong. But then that's what happens, right? Especially in Asian communities where this stuff is like, yeah, it can't be my head, right?
Yeah. There's actually a really, it's funny how you say that she kept denying the truth, because there's actually a quote in the book where she says, "You could pretend certain things weren't happening, even if you had seen or felt them. Everything done can be denied." So yeah, like literally the character tells the reader that she is purposely trying to deny everything that happened to her and had traumatized her. I do want to talk about the opening chapter, because on the first page, she says, "Here's a secret. In America, there are no good mothers. They simply don't exist. Always there are 1,000 ways to fail at this singularly important job." And then the quote goes on and ends with, "Motherhood is, if anything, the assumption of perfection." So right off the bat, you know that the other... like other mothers are able to judge our narrator because they haven't failed as badly as a mother as she did. So you, I don't know, like right off the bat, I knew that she killed her own child. I don't know about you, Marvin.
Right. I think I forgot about that as I was reading.
Oh, really?
Because part of me thought, did she kill her husband? like what was the crime. But yeah, like because they there was a refrain too. They go back to that quote at the end of the book as well.
Yeah,
talking about how to be a mother is to fail. Right, I forgot what the exact quote was.
I think I actually have. Yeah, the quote is
like,
motherhood is broken because in this place to be a good mother is to give yourself completely. It is to erase yourself. This is what I refuse to do, and that's. Like much later in the book when she actually does become a mother.
Yeah, that was a theme that repeated itself a couple times throughout the book too. I remember, I think somewhere in the middle, she was talking about how, like, I think as a nurse, right, talking about how mothers look down on you. Like if you reach for the epidural, you failed as a mother. If you like do certain things, you failed as a mother. Like even before the baby is born, there's so many ways to like be a bad mother. And I mean, she even does like she smokes while she's pregnant, right? And
yeah, I don't remember the exact quote, but there is a passage in the book where the narrator says that when babies are born, there is like so much going on before they're even born, and when they're born, they really don't stand a chance because all the grown-ups have played their parts and know the game by heart, and like the baby is just kind of like trying to catch up, and it says something about how like you said, Marvin, trauma can get passed on through generations. And I guess like with the narrator, when she does become a mother, a lot of her insecurities and her a lot of the symptoms of her trauma, it kind of traces back to her own mother, who had depressive episodes, had really wild mood swings, and just how in the narrator's childhood she kind of had to tiptoe around that.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that gets repeated throughout the book is the lessons that she picks up from observing her mother, from observing her cousin and society. And like, these are lessons that she internalizes, and it all adds up to basically who she becomes, the type of person she becomes. Like there's when she was, you know, trying to play in front of her mother's room while her mother was, you know, having one of her depressive episodes and getting smacked around for it. And that's how she learns the lessons of silence. Later when she has her own daughter, and she totally ignores her cries for hours. And so the baby learns too that like crying doesn't work.
Yeah. And I mean, with the narrator, because she can't approach her mother as easily because of her mood swings, I think that's definitely made her more secretive, I guess, like less forthcoming about like what's going on with her in her own life, which kind of, and then we get to like the end of part one, where it's revealed that the narrator got sexually abused as like an 11-year-old.
Yeah, by who she thinks is the servant. And I don't know if he got like, did they so at the end of the book, her mother reveals that she knew about it, but couldn't say anything because she was from a poor family, and if she had tried to do something about it, she was afraid she would have been thrown out. And that's where the economic anxiety comes in, where like you want to protect your daughter, but you also want to be able to provide for your daughter. And so you choose to ignore it, hoping that it'll stop. But who was it that was actually molesting her?
I think it was her father. That's what I got out of the final part.
That's what I thought too. But then why would her father bring a gun over to Samson's place? Because I thought, so that made me think it might have been like another family member, but
I mean, like another thing is like, the narrator, should we still keep calling her narrator? Because we do get her name at the end, which is Ganga. But
I mean, I'm just going to say the narrator. Yeah, because me too. Like, it seems more
more fitting.
Direct. Yeah.
Yeah, like the narrator is unreliable. Her memories aren't as clear as she thinks they are. And I would say like some memories that she kind of reminisced about, there are some holes in it. So maybe that's why it was a little bit confusing at the revelation that her father was her abuser instead of Samson.
Mm.
It's a common symptom among people who have gone through such hard trauma, to have like false memories and to have some forms of hallucinations. Because throughout the book, she kind of gets paranoid. She thinks that Samson is by her window, by her bed, even though she's in a totally different country.
Yeah. I think a lot of what part one sets up is, it sets up her initial trauma, right? It was both the sexual abuse as a child and also the death of her father, who was not a rock, but like someone who stabilized her life in Sri Lanka, right? Because after her father passed away, they had to move because the family wanted the house back, because her mother didn't come from a rich family, and because they're just women now, they couldn't be part of a rich family anymore.
Yeah.
But it also sets up the, like, all the things that run through her head about what it means to be a good daughter based on the lessons she learned from, you know, observing her parents and observing society, right? Like, and like you said, like, the biggest lesson she learns is to, like, how to keep secrets, right? Because she sees that her mother doesn't talk about it, so she won't talk about it. Like, that's the first block leading up to her crime.
I mean, I can see why she would keep all of that a secret, especially with her upbringing. Because with her mom, she could never really talk to her because she was always anxious whether or not her mom was going to accept her love that day. Because her mom could be like making crepes with her one day and kind of be like the perfect mother, and then the next day she won't get out of bed and will get snippy whenever she hears a sound outside her door. So I think the narrator, because she has this anxiety of not being able to receive love, not being able to receive stable love, I guess, she tries mm-hmm. to hang on to the love that she can get. And that kind of makes her keep those secrets, because it's the fear of, oh, if I told them that I was sexually abused as a child, like, would they still love me the same as they do now?
Yeah. And I think that comes from the, like, the cultural value of a woman being her virginity and her cleanliness, right? She was saying, you always hear about the aunties and the other, like, women talking about girls who went bad, right? Or girls who, and she even like later on in the book, when Daniel takes pretty much she's separated from Daniel and Bodhian, she talks about her being, well, I guess I turned out to be one of those ladies that, you know, men leave when they, you know, find something better. Which wasn't the case. Like, I think that was another frustrating thing. Like, she kept, like, her anxiety comes out in, like, jealousy too. And, like, yeah, like, you can see where it comes from, but it's just so also really irrational.
I think this book really, really dissects the ugliness of being a mother. Because honestly, like, I think mothers get receive the most harsh judgment in our society. And it's And she does, and she mentions this in the book as well, how, you know, when a woman gives birth, she's expected to get her bikini body like almost immediately after. Otherwise, she's a failure. And
yeah,
there are just so many, like, there's no way to win, you know? So
yeah,
like, I can see her, the reason why she had such low self-esteem, because she's going through her head and she's like, oh, what did I do wrong? Like, why am I not good enough for my husband? And what's wrong with me? And she's, and it's just like, these are things that she's seen on magazines and been told and heard yeah. from aunties. So it's already ingrained in her DNA, kind of.
I mean, that also brings us to part two, right, which is her teenage and college years in the States, where she is pretty much indoctrinated in, like, female expectations from an American lens, on top of her Sri Lankan roots, which is all about whiteness and, like, popularity and being rebellious. And you see her getting bombarded with, like, the white standard of beauty.
Like, what I found really interesting is, like, we've read novels with the whole, like, immigrants coming to the country. And what was really interesting about how this novel tackled that theme was she's trying to assimilate so she can, like, kind of throw away the identity that she had in Sri Lanka, where she's just like, oh, I can be a new person, that person who was traumatized by this horrible thing. Like, I can leave her behind in this continent. I can just deny that it didn't happen. So her yeah. assimilation is really interesting, because there's like another motive to it. And there's actually this really beautiful quote that I wrote down, and it's right before she leaves Sri Lanka for America. And it goes, how can I do this? How can I leave everything known? How can I leave language and belonging and familiar faces, faces that look like mine? How can I leave this patch of earth that has been mine? Samson taught me once that the hydrangea blooms in a range of shades depending on the soil it sinks its roots into. From faintest pink to darkest night blue, the flower reflects the acidity of its patch of earth. How am I different? This person I am, will I be killed in the transition across the planet? What new person will emerge in that other soil? So I think that passage, even though I didn't read it as eloquently as it was written, I think it really beautifully sums up the feelings that a lot of new immigrants to this country feel about leaving their motherland. And actually, she mentions how she's like, oh, people are making fun of my British English, and I can't imagine people coming to this country and not being able to speak English. Like,
yeah. And she did some, like, low key shade with throwing, like, well, we got it from the British, kind of like, yeah, we got colonized. What?
Which
was,
like,
a really clever line.
Like, it's also funny because, like, trauma is a really big theme in this book, right? And it's not just, like, the main character who has been traumatized. It's also Sri Lanka as a country. Because,
yeah,
like, the British coming and teaching them to be, quote-unquote, civilized. And we get this, like, brutal story about, one of the queens being forced to smash her children's severed heads in a giant mortar. And like, that story gets mentioned multiple times in this book. And it's just like, oh yeah, like, mothers killing their children or mothers doing terrible things to their children, that can be traced back to my ancestor or traced back into my country's history. This kind of like violence that we put upon each other, it's always been there, and it's just like continuing on with each generation.
And like, Sri Lanka keeps coming back to traumatize the family, like when her uncle dies in an accident and pretty much drives a wedge between her and the only friend she had, her cousin Darcy. Like, if every part of this book is about like a phase in her life where she had like of gaining and losing friendships too, and people come in and out of her life.
It's funny how you mentioned her uncle going back and like dying in an accident, because he died in a monsoon as well. And the narrator's father also died during a monsoon. And there's this quote where the narrator says, "Sooner or later, we pay for the woundings of our ancestors," because sometimes family isn't a place of safety. Sometimes it's a secret wound and it comes back every so often. And
yeah, I mean, death by water related causes is another theme that runs throughout the story, because, I mean, so she tries to kill her daughter at the end with sleeping pills, but in the end, it's the bay that carries her daughter away. Like, she tries to like commit suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, water related death is the leading cause of death for characters in this book.
I mean, her name is Ganga and it literally means river. So it was a motif in this novel.
Yeah, so let's go back to part two and like her assimilation into American culture. I know you were interested in talking about the how they had to change clothes at school.
they had to wear like clothes underneath their like approved clothing by their mothers, because they're like, oh, girls shouldn't wear short skirts and they shouldn't talk to boys. And it's just like all these just like the stark contrast between the two cultures was, I mean, it was entertaining to read, but also like it was very surprising. Mm-hmm. Like Darcy teaching the narrator how to shave her legs, because
yeah,
that wasn't something that people did in Sri Lanka. And I think they're teenagers in the 80s. I don't think they're actually like, I don't think it's an actual like contemporary time.
Yeah, they're talking about Duran Duran and they're talking about Wham. So this is definitely the 80s.
So it does make sense with her need to or desire to assimilate, to want to be not brown. And I mean,
Well, she was saying how she moves to Fremont, California, which these days it's very brown. But she was saying it was before that happened. She like specifically says this is before like seeing Indians, Pakistanis was commonplace in the Bay Area. And an interesting passage is her saying that when she was in Sri Lanka, she was actually considered light. People complimented her lightness. But here she is just dark.
Colorism. Hmm.
And then, I mean, the main conflict in part two comes when her and her cousin, who were best friends growing up as teens, start to drift because of her uncle's death and because of her, I guess, unwillingness to be there for her cousin, right? And that was a big thing. Like, she didn't know what to say, nor that she wanted to, like, she didn't want to be involved.
Yeah, like, it was kind of like she was avoiding Darcy because her uncle's death reminded her of her father's death. And I think the real moment where their connection got severed was when Darcy told the narrator that she was getting married, and it was an arranged marriage, and she was doing things the traditional way instead of, you know, doing it the American way, which is to find someone.
Which is what she taught. Yeah, what she taught the narrator, right? She was the one that taught her how to rebel, how to get away with wearing different clothes.
Yeah, and Darcy, like, American, whereas our narrator is an immigrant. So it's, like, I thought that was really interesting, too, because
and how much she felt it was like a betrayal, right? She felt really, really hurt by Darcy's decision.
It's her marriage was so different from the narrator's marriage, which was like through the American way. And even the wedding was completely different. Like our narrator, she didn't wear the traditional, like wedding robes of her motherland.
She decided to wear like a tradition, like a quote unquote Western.
Yeah. Like
traditional.
Dress. Like a stark white dress that her fiance bought her. That was a little bit weird for me too. I was just like, why did he buy her a dress? It's a different time.
Darcy deciding to get married is another way that like economic issues affect decisions that are made, right? Because even their mothers, right? She was talking about how back when it was just her mother and her sister, her aunt, her sister had to get married to her uncle to provide for her mother, to provide because it was just them in the family. And now that the father is gone, Darcy, she's marrying a doctor so that she can provide for her mother. Because that's how their family, that's how their relationship works.
Yeah. It was also with our narrator. She kind of wins the jackpot in the immigrant American dream, right? She gets a scholarship to UC Berkeley, a prestigious college, and she gets like a really stable job saving lives as an ICU nurse, and like to a certain extent, like she marries a white guy and
who becomes a famous artist.
Yeah, so it's so
complete. I mean, essentially on paper she's set.
Yeah, on paper she's set, but it's just weird because she went through this really unconventional marriage. I mean, unconventional compared to Sri Lankan culture. But but like Darcy, like it seemed like she had a pretty satisfactory marriage. She like at the end of the book, you realize you learn that she has three children and she's like, she has like this great life, even though.
Well, that was the other refrain from the book in defense of arranged marriages, saying that, you know, love can fade, but a marriage is a partnership. So if you treat it as a partnership, eventually things will make sense. And that was what, you know, I forgot who said that, but it's part of some auntie or
auntie.
But that was kind of another theme of this book is, you know, relationships that are based in love. And I mean, that was that's the main conflict in the third part, right? So the third part is after she graduates from Berkeley, she becomes a nurse and meets Daniel, who is
who's a
painter.
Who's like an art dealer or an art handler before he actually gets discovered and becomes a San Francisco art rock star.
And she pretty much gets him through his lean years, right? His years as a struggling artist, having to deal with, you know, her mother saying, "How's your friend and his art?" And
super relatable, by the way.
Yeah, and you learn that she like falls deeply in love with him, but then the love also brings out like the worst sides of her sometimes. And that this is when she starts, you know, she's always had like PTSD episodes manifest as nightmares, but this is when she starts kind of acting out, right? Like smashing glasses and like.
Yeah, I would say like.
Driving off.
I would say like her hallucinations of seeing Samson at the corner of her eye definitely increases. Her nightmares become more lucid. And like with Daniel, she she hadn't been with anybody else before Daniel. Like, she was pretty much committed to being single and not having a love life. She just wanted to solely dedicate herself to her career because I personally think that she thought that she would never be loved because of what happened to her, because she wasn't, I guess, for the lack of a better word, quote unquote, pure.
Yeah, she goes through like imposter syndrome, right? Like, on paper, she has a great life, a great boyfriend. Like, things are going well, but she never, like, she's constantly afraid that, especially like dating a white guy, like, she's constantly afraid that, like, people will discover her secret. And, like, similar to, like, after she moved to the States, like, she is in constant fear of people seeing her as a monster, which is what she sees herself as, right?
Yeah, like, she even mentions in a passage that, like, it feels like there's a minotaur inside, like, the labyrinth of her mind. There is something crawling within her. Like, I think she uses the word water weed. And, like, in the first part of the novel, you realize that after the assault happened, she started self-harming herself. And
yeah,
those tendencies, I don't know if they completely return when she becomes a mother, but it definitely takes a darker turn. Like, those dark thoughts that she had as a child has now, like, she carried it with her into adulthood. I would say, like, this book is about how, like, trauma just sinks into your bones. It just becomes, like,
it's like, here is, like, worst case scenario of, like, what this stuff does to you.
Like, it's just, like, with her mother, like, the narrator's mother, it's like, oh, you have a broken mother who gives birth to a broken child, and the broken child grows up to becoming a broken mother, and it just propagates, you know? And it's, and there is a quote in the book that I thought was striking, and it was, shame is female. Shame is the price I must pay for this body. And yeah, like, our narrator, she is always fighting with this shame inside her, even though, like, she on paper has a good life and has, like, a great potential to live a great life. But
yeah, that says something about just how society views women, right? The pressure that society in general puts on being female, right? As a female, you're expected to be all these things. Like,
yeah, like, it's really heartbreaking, I guess. Like, it's really sad that motherhood is kind of defined on sacrificing your entire being, right? Like, you have to, like, give up everything about yourself to provide for your child. And with fatherhood, it's not, I mean, personally, I don't think it's held up to that high of a standard.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in, like, a lot of aspects of, like, even with, you know, the current Me Too movement and what it draws from, you know, like, the different expectations of men and women in the office, even, you know, expectations of, you're supposed to be this one way, and if you're not, then you're a failure as a woman or as a person. She, in fact, suffers from these expectations from two cultures. So part three goes through, goes up to her deciding to get married to Daniel. And then part four is about her having her child, Bodhi Ann, who...
actually is, like, Daniel and the narrator weren't planning to be parents ever, but then like, she finds out that she's pregnant, and she is actually on, like, she actually agrees to go to an abortion clinic because
what did you think about that chapter where he convinces her to, like, yeah, we're not ready for this?
Which part?
He's kind of being,
because, like, first it was like, oh, we can't handle being parents.
Yeah, the part where he actually, yeah, what did you think about that part where he actually tries to convince her, like, before he has a change of mind, when he's like, yeah, we can't handle this baby?
I'm gonna sound like a terrible person for saying this, but I was like, okay, yeah, that's a logical decision.
But then at the end, he stops her right before she goes through with it. They have a child.
Yeah, they have a child. And, like, honestly, like, being a parent is like a really big decision. It's probably the biggest decision you'll ever make in your life. Because with a child, the responsibilities and, like, the number of hours that you have to care for this kid, it doesn't just go away when they're 18 years old. Like, you're a parent forever. So it's, like, it is a really hard decision, you know? So that's why I was like, okay, yeah, if you're not ready to parent, it, then...
Ultimately, seeing how the book ends, that probably would have been the best way to go. Becoming a parent, it recenters your life, right? You're no longer the center of your own life once you become a parent. And that's something that the narrator wasn't ready for.
Yeah, like, once you become a parent, you're not a victim anymore. So I feel really terrible for even thinking that maybe the narrator would have been better off without her child. But at some point, like, in the book, she says, I love my child, but I don't like motherhood. And it doesn't mean that she's a bad mom, like nothing like that. And it doesn't mean that she doesn't love her kid. But with her PTSD and with her not getting help for it, like, there were a lot of
things that went wrong. It's a bad deal.
It's a bad comp.
Yeah. I mean, you start to see the cracks form when she starts, like, ignoring the kid for long periods of time. And also how she sees... she fluctuates between seeing them as, like, a family unit and seeing the baby as an obstacle between her and her husband. And I think that's when you start seeing, like, oh, this is starting to get dark. I mean, it's already dark, but this is going down, like, a dark path now.
But I'm not a mother, but, like, I can understand, like, not loving your child 24/7. Of course, there's going to be moments when you have some sort of resentment to your child, not like hatred, but it's just like, oh, if you, like, I wish I was able to do these things, but I'm being tied down, or because one thing or the other. But
what did you think about the birth scene? Because
that was really darkly humorous, because she's like, I am not going to get an epidural. I am going to give birth as my mother and her grandmother, like, did before me. And I think at some point she even entertained the thought of getting, like, a midwife, but Daniel was just like, no, we're gonna take you to the hospital. Like, I want you to, like, what if something goes wrong? I want you to be surrounded by surgeons and clean hospital sheets. And, like, during her labor, she's in so much pain that she does get the epidural.
Yeah. But yeah, the whole scene, it reminded me of listening to, like, people describe how, like, having kids is probably society's biggest joke on you, because everyone says it's the magic of birth and it's such a great experience, but the actual experience is horrifying. And the actual, like, first year of parenthood is exhausting. And, like, you kind of feel like, yeah, like, the world played a joke on you. This isn't the best thing ever.
I thought it was really funny when she was, like, mentioning how, like, mommies in the playground would kind of tell their battle stories, being like, oh yeah. Boy, I was in labor for like 72 hours. And they're just kind of like showing up on each other on like how much pain they went through in their labor. And it's just like, yeah.
And then, yeah, after having the baby, her daughter turns out to be extremely fair. And that bothers her too, right? And that causes her problems when she takes her out because people think she's the nanny. And
yeah, it really did like all of like the all of her thoughts on have on being in an interracial relationship and how like Bodhi doesn't really look much like her and she yeah. can pretty much pass for white. And that was something that she wanted when she was growing up in high school and wanting to be like the other white girls and being like able to belong easily.
Yeah. For his part, I feel like Daniel did a pretty good job of trying to make things work, right? Like he wanted to learn how to eat with his hands, like, you know, Sri Lankans do. He, you know, defended her in front of like...
I had my concerns when he was introduced, especially when...
Yeah, because he had that Japanese print on his wall.
Yeah. So I was like, oh,
yellow fever dude. Like,
no, that's a red flag right there. And also just like, I was like, okay, like, is this relationship going to be him kind of like being a weeaboo in a way, like
yeah.
is it gonna be like that, or is it gonna be or is it gonna be like in Everything I Never Told You where race is kind of out of the conversation and they do their best to just ignore that part of the narrator's life. So,
yeah.
But like it was very like I was very pleasantly surprised that he was just like, yeah, like teach me how to eat the way that you do, cook me these food, and I want to know more about your family and your childhood. And he seemed like really interested in her life, and I guess that makes
and he
it
was,
more tragic that she didn't confide in him on all the things that she
yeah did. There was that one passage where he was talking about his past and about the big break that didn't happen in New York, right? And she was kind of seeing that, like, it seems like he doesn't live with any shame. That was her takeaway from the conversation. I think that's, again, the key thing is, like, she lives with so much shame. Yeah, it seemed like another way that she was not good enough for him, or in her mind, right? She was, like, not... Because she carried so much shame that she was just another taking like the I don't deserve this stuff box.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seems to be a recurring trait because like with pretty much all of the relationships that she's had, she's kind of been desperate for love. And when she finally gets Daniel, who turns out to be a very understanding and loving partner, she thinks that she's not good enough because she has been so desperate for all those years.
Yeah. And I mean, it all comes to a head at the end where she does the thing. She kills her daughter.
That was really hard to read. Like actually yeah. before that happened, she calls her mom in Sri Lanka because like she's having, you know, she's separated from Daniel because of her mental state. And
yeah.
and her mom was just like, oh, like I'm so sorry. Like maybe I should have like done something about it. And maybe you wouldn't be living with this trauma, with this shame. Maybe things would be different.
And, yeah.
and that's when it's revealed that like for the first time, the narrator mentioned Samson. And her mom's just like, what are you talking about? It wasn't Samson. It was somebody else. And we kind of get the hint that it was her dad. And that's kind of like, that kind of becomes the catalyst for her, like killing her daughter. Cause she's
yeah.
get paranoid. She's like, oh my God, if my dad did this to me, then like Daniel could do this to our daughter, and then she'll have to live with all the shame that I had to carry my entire life. So,
yeah, she did mention that she started seeing all of Daniel's moments with her as with suspicion now. And it's, you know, and like, yeah, because Daniel took Bodhi away because he was concerned for her safety, right?
Yeah. And at the time, the narrator, she thought that maybe he was seeing another woman. Maybe it was like another white woman. And she kind of had this fantasy thinking about like him leaving her for another white woman and that white woman becoming Bodhi's stepmother, and then them living as like a happy family unit without like a trace of her in their lives. And yeah, like a lot of insecurities, a lot of
that was a really tough just chapter, because that all happens in one chapter, like her complete breakdown. And like after she jumps off the bridge and seeing her like realize that, oh, what have I done?
Yeah, like it's like a moment where she thinks that she's protecting her child by killing her child, but then like once she does the deed, it's almost as if like Claire
becomes, she becomes yeah,
she's like, oh, like this, like what have I done, like this is way worse than what I thought it would be. Yeah, it was a really hard chapter to read, particularly because Bodhi was so trusting of her mom, right? Because her mom gives her orange juice that's drugged with sleeping pills. And she says, oh, the orange juice tastes funny. And her mom's like, oh, like drink all of it and be a good girl. And because her daughter, she's used to seeing the narrator's episodes, she's just like, oh, I should just listen to what my mom says because I want mom to be happy instead of sad.
Yeah.
And
which is similar to how she was as a child.
Yeah. And that's what made it really hard for me to read.
Yeah.
It was so, I don't think I can read this book a second time, but like it was a journey. It was a beautifully written book.
Yeah.
And God.
I mean, there was something of an Easter egg in it. Goodreads member Julie points out that she does, I think in chapter 3, she mentioned someone saying, oh, yeah, Sri Lanka, that was in that book. Island of something.
Island of a Thousand Years.
And then she was like, how could someone in America possibly know what it's like to be in Sri Lanka? Which Island of a Thousand Mirrors, it was Naomi Munaria's previous book. So good catch there.
I don't know. Like, I thought that was pretty funny. also, I was just like, imposter syndrome much? But I was like, no, I think it was just like a funny Easter egg thing.
Yeah.
And I guess because we've been talking for a while, I wanted to ask you what you thought about Darcy's reappearance at the end of the novel.
I mean, I ended up seeing this story as like a character study in someone who goes through all this trauma, but never, this is a reality for a lot of people living with, you know, PTSD from childhood trauma / growing up in patriarchal misogynist cultures, but also showing that it's not like, I think Darcy's, even from the beginning of part 2, her character has always been a contrast to the narrator's. Her life is literally like the opposite of her cousin's.
It's the opposite, but I mean, they both lose a parent and they are, I mean, like they're,
but they both go through similar
trials, I guess, traumas. Except for Darcy not being a victim of sexual abuse. But yeah, it's kind of like an alternate version of Ganga. It's just like, oh, this is how she could have been if all this terrible stuff wasn't weighing on her.
So in the end, its point is to show that like a lot of who the main character was a cause of unintended consequences of a lot of good intentions, which is a theme that we've seen again and again.
I wonder how, because neither of us are parents, I wonder how people who are parents, like, I wonder what their thoughts were on this book, because I'm sure...
I would love to hear your thoughts. If you're a parent, please comment on our Goodreads forum, those of you who have read the book.
Yeah, I am very curious, because I feel like I'm very cynical about parenthood. So all of my comments so far in this episode has just been like, yeah, motherhood sounds like it sucks. I'm just like, why would anybody want to be a mom? But that's just me being cynical. I would love to hear you guys' thoughts on the book if you're a parent.
I guess let's wrap up. Any final thoughts about the story?
Final thoughts. I just, the prose was so beautiful. I had to write down a lot of quotes, and I've only said a few of them in this episode because then this episode would be like 2 hours long. But like, just the way like everything was written so crisply and beautifully, I really enjoyed reading it, and the fact that it was written beautifully softened the blow a little bit whenever I read the more horrific parts.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's such a beautifully written story, even when things get real dark.
Like, it's going to stick with us for a couple of years.
Yeah, I see why people recommended it, and I see why, you know, some I think a Twitter user mentioned it was like her favorite book of 2017. Well, that'll do it for our discussion of What Lies Between Us by Naomi Munawira. Thanks again for listening in, and if you have your own thoughts you want to get off your chest, please move on to our Goodreads forums. We have a thread going with discussion on this book. And like Rira and I said, we'd really love to hear from you if you are a parent and have read this book, what your thoughts are.
Yeah. With that said, again, our April book club pick is One Day We'll All Be Dead and None of This Will Matter by Scotchy Cole. I read maybe the first 50 pages of it, and like, I'm so glad we're reading this after What Lies Between Us, because it's much lighter.
Oh, great. Because that title seemed pretty dark.
It's lighter because there's comedy, but a lot of the topics are serious. It talks about having anxiety and being a woman of color and racism. So, yeah, there are heavy topics, but it's delivered in a very comedic way. So I'm really glad we're reading this for April. And
I'm excited.
And for May, we're reading The Leavers by Lisa Koh. The paperback should be out by the end of April. So it should be available in bookstores by then.
Great. And as always, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. If you enjoy listening to us talk about book stuff, please give us a rating review on iTunes. It really helps us out. And please recommend us to any of your friends who want to get into reading books, especially books by Asian and Asian American authors.
Also, feel free to recommend books to us, because I like finding new books and adding them to my collection. So I guess maybe that's more of a personal goal for me. So I guess hit me up on Twitter and recommend books to me.
Awesome. So for Books and Boba, thanks for listening, and we'll see y'all next time.
All right, bye. Keep reading.
This episode of Books and Boba was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited by Marvin Yue. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian American community. If you like this episode of Books and Boba, you should also check out the Potluck Podcast Saturday School. Saturday School is a pop culture history podcast where hosts Ada Sang and Brian Hu explore the history of Asian American films. You can listen to Saturday School and the other great programs of the Potluck Collective by going to the website podcastpotluck.com.